that Phosphorus was dropped in Gaza near the port area, and their description of what it looked like and smelled like was consistent with the use of white phosphorus. Amnesty International followed up with their own reporting where they were able to verify, you know, additional areas in which white phosphorus was used. They were able to look at, you know, footage that was provided by the Israeli government of some of the weapon systems being used in Gaza, again, being able to source it. It was white phosphorus that was being carried by those planes. And of course, we're talking about a weapon that is, when dropped in civilian areas, is unlawful because it can, you know, burn homes and other structures. It can leave life, cause lifelong suffering for the communities that live there. The fact that the Israeli government is using it, and let's note that they have, even when not used as a weapon, even when white phosphorus is used for signaling or obscuring the army, it can cause harm to civilians. And the Israeli army has readily available alternatives that have much of the same effect in terms of signaling or obscuring without the harm it causes to civilian populations. Its use is...
Well, Omar Shachar, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Israel and Palestine director at Human Rights Watch, also authored the landmark 2021 Human Rights Watch report titled A Threshold Crossed, Israeli Authorities and the Crimes of Apartheid and Persecution. Coming up, Israeli historian, Holocaust scholar Raz Siegel. He says Israel's assault on Gaza is a textbook case of genocide. Back in 30 seconds.
I need your guidance. Help me feel. There's so much love, there's so much warmth. There are no words. You're my home where I feel safe. You're always there, always cared. You're always down.
Where Do We Go From Here by Sand Moon. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A textbook case of genocide. Israel has been explicit about what it's carrying out in Gaza. Why isn't the world listening? That's the headline of a new piece in Jewish Currents by our next guest, Raz Siegel. He's an Israeli historian, associate professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Stockton University, where he's also an endowed professor in the study of modern genocide. Raz Siegel joins us now from Philadelphia. Professor Siegel, welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out your case.
Thank you for having me. I think that indeed what we're seeing now in Gaza is a case of genocide. We have to understand that the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide from 1948 requires that we see special intent for genocide to happen. And to quote the convention, intent to destroy a group as defined as racial, ethnic, religious, or national, as such, that is collectively, not just individuals. And this intent, as we just heard, is on full display by Israeli politicians and army officers since 7th of October. We heard Israel's president. It's well known what Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said on 9th of October, declaring a complete siege on Gaza, cutting off water, food, fuel, stating that we're fighting human animals and we will react accordingly. He also said that we will eliminate everything. We know that Israeli army spokesperson Daniel Hagari, for example, acknowledged one-tune destruction and said explicitly the emphasis is on damage and not on accuracy. So we're seeing this special intent on full display. And really, I have to say, if this is not special intent to commit genocide, I really don't know what is. So when we look at the actions taken, the dropping of thousands and thousands of bombs in a couple of days, including phosphorus bombs, as we heard, on one of the most densely populated areas around the world, together with these proclamations of intent, this indeed constitutes genocidal killing, which is the first act, according to the convention, of genocide. And Israel, I must say, is also perpetrating act number 2 and 3 that is causing seriously serious bodily or mental harm, and creating condition designed to bring about the destruction of the group by cutting off water, food, supply of energy, bombing hospitals, ordering the fast evictions of hospitals, which the World Health Organization has declared to be, quote, a death sentence. So we're seeing the combination of genocidal acts with special intent. This is indeed a textbook case of genocide.
Can you talk about the displacement? Israel saying that the entire northern Gaza, now hundreds of thousands of people have complied, must move south. The northern part of Gaza is the most populated with Gaza City.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as is well known, this is an impossible order. It's impossible for specific groups of people in hospitals, people defined as disabled, elderly people, many Palestinians who refuse to leave their homes because of their histories and their memories of the Nakba. This is an impossible order. It's yet another indication of the intent to destroy, the intent to commit genocide. It's also worthwhile to emphasize Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, new term that he coined, complete siege. It seems like a completely new term that really takes the what was already a 17-year siege on Gaza, the longest in modern history, which is already a clear violation of international humanitarian law. It takes this siege and now turns it into a complete siege, which really signals the turn to this kind of genocidal destruction that we're seeing, including with this eviction order. It's also worthwhile to try to explain, I think, why Israel is so explicit in its declaration. We've heard Israel president talk about evil. We've also heard about Biden's use of the word evil. EU leaders describe the Hamas attack as evil. And it has to be said, the Hamas attack were clear war crimes, the mass murder of more than 1,000 Israeli civilians, a horrendous war crime that rightfully shocked many Israelis and many, many people around the world. But evil is not a term to describe them. Evil is a term to decontextualize. Evil is a term to demonize and to really enhance the widespread fantasies of Israelis today that they're fighting Nazis. Actually, former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said that directly in an interview yesterday. Today, we are fighting Nazis. We see this in many, many other indications in Israeli society and politics today. And if we're fighting Nazis, then everything is permissible.
Professor no Siegel, law. I actually wanted to go to the former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who's currently in the Israeli army. This is from a few days ago, where he exploded at the Sky News anchor Kamali Melbourne during an interview Thursday when Melbourne pressed him on Israel's attacks on Palestinian civilians. This is a part of what he said.
What about those Palestinians in hospital who are on life support and babies and incubators whose life support and incubator will have to be turned off because the Israelis have cut the power to Gaza?
Are you seriously keep on asking me about Palestinian civilians? What's wrong with you? Have you not seen what happened? We're fighting Nazis. We don't target them. Now, the world can come and bring them anything they want. If you want to bring them electricity, I'm not going to feed electricity or water to my enemies. If anyone else wants, that's fine. We're not responsible for them.
This is the point.
But you
this
keep
is
on.
The point.
You,
no,
Mr. Bennett,
I
want to tell
point.
You. No, man, no, listen. You listen
no, you're
to
raising
me
your
right
voice,
now.
And
I've heard
trying,
you enough.
No, I understand. We're trying to have a conversation here. Listen, this is my program. This is my show. And I am asking the questions.
Exactly.
You're raising your voice,
yeah,
and I've asked you, and we've already stopped, please, and let me finish. We've already distinguished between
you,
Hamas.
Mister. I want to tell you,
you're trying to speak over me.
We
no, no.
are not, shame on you.
It's nothing about shame. We're trying to have
minister.
A conversation
There's
about a very serious situation here, and you are refusing
you
to address it.
So that is the former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett exploding at the Sky News anchor Kamali Melbourne. Professor Siegel, you're an Israeli historian. This is what you're talking about when he uses the Nazi analogy. And also when he says, are you seriously talking about Palestinian civilians? Your response.
That's exactly what we're. It's very important to understand that in this context, the idea of fighting Nazis, the idea of using Holocaust memory in this way. There's a broad context, a long history, of course, of this shameful use of Holocaust memory, which Israeli politicians have used to justify, rationalize, deny, distort, disavow mass violence against Palestinians. And it has allowed also a view to develop that sees Israel as somehow exceptional, providing it impunity. The truth, however, is that all perpetrators of genocide actually see their victims as dangerous, as vicious, as inhuman, right? That's how the Nazis saw the Jews, and that's how today Israelis see Palestinians. And that's why the lessons of the Holocaust actually, which were never meant to provide cover and rationalize state violence and genocide, but rather protect groups, especially stateless and defenseless groups, groups under military occupation and siege from violent states. The lessons of the Holocaust are now very, very urgent. We need to center the voices of those facing state violence and genocide, and we need to move to prevention as fast as possible. In order to do that, we need to recognize what's going on around us, what's unfolding in front of our eyes, which is really a textbook case of genocide with the rhetoric, with the actions, with everything involved.
Roz Siegel is Associate Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Stockton University and the Endowed Professor in the Study of Modern Genocide. He's an Israeli historian. His new article for Jewish Currents will link to A Textbook Case of Genocide. The subtitle, Israel's been explicit about what it's carrying out in Gaza. Why isn't the world listening? Back in 30 seconds. Gracious Man by Rabia Abu Khalil. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. On Friday, an Israeli artillery strike reportedly landed among a group of international journalists covering clashes near Lebanon's border with Israel, killing 37-year-old Reuters videographer Aysem Abdellah, who was part of a Reuters crew providing a live video signal. Six others were injured in the strike, including reporters for AFP, that's Agence France-Presse, and Al Jazeera. The Lebanese army said in a statement, Israeli troops fired the shell that struck the journalist. Lebanon's foreign ministry has requested a complaint be filed by Beirut's mission to the United Nations over what it called a, quote, flagrant violation, a crime against freedom of opinion and press, unquote. The Israel Defense Forces say the incident is being looked into. Reuters says it's, quote, urgently seeking more information, working with authorities in the region, supporting Aysem's family and colleagues. Just before the show, just before yet another funeral for Aysem, I spoke with one of his closest friends, Lema Alarian. She's an international producer for Vice News based in Beirut, Lebanon. I asked her to describe what happened.
Well, Amy, since the bombing of Gaza began, there's been a lot of tensions and flare-ups in the south of Lebanon between Israel and different groups there. And he was one of the many journalists who traveled there to cover what was happening. He was in a group, in a press scrum, and a group of journalists were standing right in front of the Israeli border, clearly marked as press, you know, wearing their jackets, wearing their helmets, and doing just live positions. They weren't embedded with any sort of group. They were just there, you know, to tell the story of what was happening in the south. He even posted a selfie a few, maybe like 30 minutes before the events took place, you know, just showing what was happening. He was wearing his jacket and his helmet, and then, you know, speaking to journalists who were there and also watching the Reuters live feed, which caught the moment they were hit. Two Israeli strikes, we're not sure what kind of artillery yet, hit them. And one of them, unfortunately, killed our friend and beloved journalist Aysam, and injured six other journalists, including Christine Alassi, who's still undergoing surgery at the moment.
And who did they all work for?
There were journalists from the AFP, there were journalists from Reuters, there were journalists from Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera had been there for many days doing lives from this very position. Nobody thought that they were unsafe there. I saw somebody who used to call me reckless and say that I'm worried about you, because he was somebody who really valued safety. And he's been to many conflict zones, and he just always put safety of colleagues and himself, you know, even before the story. And so that's why many of his colleagues and his friends think that they were targeted, because there was no like Hezbollah members or any members of armed groups in that area. It was just a group of journalists who were hit.
And where did the airstrike come from, and where exactly did it hit?
It came definitely from the direction of Israel, because they were standing right in front of the border. Of course, there's going to be investigations into this, but this is from eyewitnesses who were there, including his colleagues who survived the attack. The Lebanese army has also made a statement saying that it came from the direction of Israel and it was an Israeli strike. The Lebanese prime minister said the same thing, the acting prime minister, Najib Mikati. And when the Israeli officials were asked about this, they, of course, haven't taken any responsibility yet. The Israeli ambassador to the United Nations even was a little bit callous. He says, "We're sorry, we'll look into it, but we're in a time of war and things happen." So it came, you know, as his colleagues, eyewitnesses, and friends say, it was, and many, many official reports, it came from Israel, but it's very unlikely that there'll be any accountability.
Did Aysam die immediately?
It seems from the videos that were published online, the very grim videos, that he did die immediately. You can hear other colleagues screaming in the background, saying, my legs, I can't feel my legs. You have, you know, Dylan from the Associated Press, or, sorry, you have Dylan from AFP, who immediately ran to help his colleague. He put a tourniquet over her leg. When the second strike came, he was saying yesterday he wasn't sure if it was the first strike or the second strike that killed Aysam. But unfortunately, I've been looking for his voice in any of the videos that have been published, you know, especially immediately after the attack, when I was trying to figure out if my friend was safe or not. And I couldn't hear his voice, so I think it was an immediate death.
How did you learn?
I read on Twitter that a journalist had been injured, and I immediately started to call his friends, and they were all, you know, trying to also find out more information. And I kept calling his phone, and usually during, you know, any big incidents that happen in the country, like the Beirut explosion, he just declines my phone call. But this is the first time that I didn't get, like, a declined phone call, or him picking up saying, "I'm busy, I'm working, but I'm okay." And so I just, unfortunately, I just felt that it was him who had passed away. We knew that he was with the other journalists that day. And it was a Reuters live feed that had caught the moment of impact, which, you know, he was running with two of his other colleagues who traveled here from Iraq.
When was the last time you saw him?
I was actually just with Aysam and a group of his friends, you know, 2 days before he passed away, and a day before he traveled to the South. He was telling me that he was going to cover these events, but he was also mentioning, you know, how broken up he was about the images coming out of the Gaza Strip, and also how upset he was by the coverage of, you know, many Western media outlets regarding this war. He'd also told a friend earlier that this, he had also told a friend earlier last week that, you know, he was worried about safety concerns along the border. And what he feared most was that if he was to pass away or to die, or nobody would name his killer.
Can you tell us about the funeral?
The funeral was, of course, extremely sad. It took place in South Lebanon, you know, amongst the olive and pomegranate trees, which he loved so much. We've taken trips there in the past where we've drank coffee in the homes of his aunts who all lived there. And I know that he loved, you know, Lebanon very much. He loved the South very much. It took place again in his hometown, Khiyam, which is a place that saw a lot of war and destruction previously. It was under, I think, 22 years of Israeli occupation before it was liberated May 25th, 2000. So, of course, there's a lot of symbolism there. And it was attended by, you know, a lot of officials from many different political parties and, of course, many, many journalist friends of his. He was buried along with his press jacket. And on top of his grave, they lined his grave with his cameras.
Why did he become a journalist?
I think the reason why Issam really became a journalist is to tell stories from, you know, this region that he cared about so much and that he thinks is very misunderstood by Western media. And he worked for Reuters for a very long time, covering, you know, many different stories. He covered the Egyptian Revolution in 2011, which I know he was very proud of. He covered stories from Lebanon after the explosion. He was one of the first journalists to go straight to the port. He interviewed injured people. He, you know, always took risks to make sure that people's voices got out there. He covered the war in Ukraine. He was, you know, interviewing grieving mothers. He was in Turkey after the earthquake, you know, for weeks interviewing people living in the rubble. He was there when they were pulling people out from under the rubble. He was there, you know, covering funerals, and he just always wanted to, you know, show the humanity of people suffering.
And why had he gone to the border that day with the other journalists?
He went to the border that day because there was, you know, back and forth fire between Israel and different armed groups in Lebanon because of what was happening in Gaza. You know, tensions and flare-ups started to happen at the border. And, you know, that was his job. His job was to go and, you know, tell people what was happening.
Lema, I'm talking to you today right before you're going to another funeral for Issam.
Yes, he was somebody who was extremely loved within the community. And, you know, it's very common in Muslim and Arab culture to go and, you know, spend the first week with the family. So that's what we're going to be doing, to try to give them, you know, as much support as possible to the family members, to the journalists who've also, you know, had to mourn their colleague, but also keep, you know, working, reporting on what's been happening in Gaza, reporting on what's been happening inside Lebanon, and also the very real, also preparing for the very real possibility that there could be, you know, another war here.
Finally, Lemat, your sister Layla wrote a piece about your family and about your grandfather buying land in Gaza, investing his life savings, and about what's happened to your own family in this last week in Gaza. Could you tell us about that?
Of course. I mean, this is what I've been telling friends, like, who've been sending condolences. This is the second time this week, you know, friends from around the world have had to send me condolences. Earlier this week, my mother lost 11 of her extended family members in a single airstrike on their family home inside Gaza. And that was already, you know, very difficult to on my mother and, of course, on our family. I didn't know these family members very well, but, you know, it was still extremely heartbreaking to see, you know, videos of, you know, people who share our last name on the internet, pulling out, you know, dead children from the rubble and injured people. And, you know, amongst the people that were killed was a 6-month-year-old baby named Zainuddin.
That was Lema Alarian, an international producer for Vice News, speaking to us from Beirut, Lebanon, about her dear friend, Aysem Abdullah, the Reuters videographer killed last week, reportedly in an Israeli airstrike while reporting on the Israel-Lebanon border. The strike injured six other journalists as well. In the first week of fighting in Gaza, the Committee to Protect Journalists reports at least 12 journalists have been killed. More are missing and injured. We're joined now by CPJ's Middle East and North Africa program coordinator, Sharif Mansour. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Sharif. In these last few minutes we have, we've heard the story of Aysem. Tell us what you understand about what's happened to journalists. He was on the Israel-Lebanon border. Israel says they're looking into it. What's happening in Gaza?
Well, this is the deadliest time for journalists in Gaza. That is, according to our count, one of the highest toll for journalists covering the conflict since 1992. Since 2001, we've recently published stories of 20 Palestinian journalists who have been killed over the years, covering IDF operations. Many of them, 13, were in Gaza before the start of this war. But right now, we're looking at least 10 Palestinian journalists, mostly freelance photojournalists, who are taking outsized challenge and risk in order to tell the story of what's happening. But there are, in addition to Aysem from Lebanon, at least one or two journalists from Israel who've been killed and went missing since the beginning of the raid on October 7. We're also still investigating a lot of damages to media facilities in Gaza that were bombed over the course of the week, reportedly at least 48 or so. Many were injured, many lost their homes, and many cannot access the outside world because of lack of internet.
So let me ask you, what are the international laws and conventions in place to safeguard journalists and hold those responsible for their killings?
Well, we call on Israel to immediately investigate what happened to Aysem and his six colleagues who were injured. We support the Lebanon complaint in the UN to make an investigation. And we also call on Brazil, who is residing right now on this week on the UN Security Council, to make sure that journalist safety is included in any talks that's happening diplomatically.
And let me ask you, last week, BBC Arabic journalists Mohamed Tatunji and Haitham Abu Diab were reportedly stopped, assaulted, and held at gunpoint by Israeli police in Tel Aviv. What do you know about this situation?
Unfortunately, censorship is widespread, not just covering Gaza in Israel. And we've seen and reported a lot of journalists being threatened live, including from Al-Arabi TV just couple of days ago, and journalists have told us they have received threats. In addition to all the misinformation that has been, spread to justify those attacks against journalists, and we saw the Israeli government right now making decrees to censor and close Palestinian media outlets and inciting against even Israeli journalists who would quote unquote harm national during the war.
And I wanted to ask, on Friday, the U.S. news organization Semaphore reported, quote, MSNBC has quietly taken three of its Muslim broadcasters out of the anchor's chair since Hamas's attack on Israel last Saturday amidst America's wave of sympathy for Israeli terror victims. The article detailed how Mehdi Hassan, Ayman Mualdin, and Ali Velshi have all seen their roles reduced over the past week, even though the three have some of the deepest knowledge of the region at the network, as Semaphore reported. Your final comments on this?
Well, journalists must provide accurate, independent account of what's happening, including in time of crisis. We rely on them so that the misinformation that we see does not fuel the conflict. We rely on them so that we know the motivation and the implication of all the warring parties. And we rely on them to expose any potential for human rights violation or war crimes. So we call for the absolute resilience of journalists and the support of their editors so that they can do their job fairly without censorship.
Sharif Mansour, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. That does it for our show. A happy birthday to Juan Gonzalez and Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week, I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.